This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown. It's a special online-only edition for Monday, the 14th of May, 2007. KVMR is undergoing a membership drive at this moment, and Booktown has been preempted for more lucrative programming. But I'm going to be doing a regular program, or somewhat irregular program, featuring first mystery writers Marcia Muller and Bill Bronzini, who will be appearing at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City this Friday, the 18th of May. And in the second half of the program, I'm going to devote it to the life and work of Kurt Vonnegut, who died just about a month ago, a little over a month ago. Many people have read many of his books. Many people may have heard him talk. I'm going to probably read a little bit from one of his books, and we can listen together to what he has to say on a number of topics over the years. I talked to Marcia Muller and Bill Bronzini last week. They're very prolific mystery writers, quite well known and very successful. They've both written long series featuring particular detectives. Hers is Sharon McCone, who's been going since the early 70s, and his is The Nameless Detective, although in recent years we've at least found out that his first name is Bill. He's also been going since the early 70s. They have over 20 novels apiece about either of these individual detectives. They've also written several of them together. One of the first things I asked them was what it was like writing long series like these rather than independent novels that stand on their own, and how their readers respond to them. This is what Marcia Muller had to say.
I've actually heard it described as getting a letter from an old friend.
And does that mean that when you start working on a novel, you think about the characters or you think about a plot?
For both of us, I think it comes out of character. The novel is very character-driven, and very often the plot will change according to what the characters say and do.
You mean sometimes? Excuse me. Sometimes I begin with a theme, some particular concept I want to explore. But it's only, the plot itself almost always comes out of character.
And the characters have gotten so. Their worlds have gotten so real, and the people who work with them in their various detective agencies, that you've even started to borrow from each other. Or at least I know in Nightcrawlers, the nameless detective goes, when he has a problem he can't, a computer problem he can't deal with, he goes to the McCone investigations.
Mm-hmm. We do that. There's a lot of inside trading back and forth in both our series.
They're very character-driven, but also very procedural, and quite often the the mystery is not that great a mystery. Sometimes it's a question of how the characters are going to deal with the emotional complexities as much as anything.
That's true. That's very true. We're much more interested in the character development and the impact of crime on individuals, both series characters and other characters. We're a lot more interested in that than we are in whodunit.
It's more a why done it, I would think. Why? What drives the person to commit these horrendous crimes?
But then it's also a question of what drives your detectives to go after them, because sometimes they go usually well and above and beyond the call of duty or what they're being paid for.
That's true. I mean, they become emotionally involved in their cases.
Sometimes it's almost, in both of the books of yours I've read recently, each of them was just a few months away from a horrendous incident. In a previous case, and suddenly they were on top of another one. Is it hard for them to keep their emotional balance?
In some cases, yes. My book that's coming in July, called The Ever-Running Man, has Sharon investigating a series of bombings in her husband's company that may very well threaten their marriage. And the book that I'm writing right now, she is withdrawn to a distant place to think over her future because she's feeling totally burned out as a result of recent cases.
And I'm assuming, I'm just guessing, is Hy Rapinski her husband, or did other things happen?
Hy Rapinski is and still is her husband.
Okay, because where I am, they're still building their house on the coast, and this is in a walk through the fire, and their relationship had suffered a pretty serious threat.
Yeah, every now and then I have to shake up that relationship because otherwise it would get too static and too settled. So I'm always throwing little surprises at them.
And almost too perfect now that in a walk through the fire, she was around 40 and had been in the business for quite some time, and by now she had a pilot's license and he was a pilot, and it seemed like they had unbelievably fortunate lives.
Yes, it did, until the next disaster happened.
In the next book?
In any number of them after a walk through the fire.
Uh-huh. So they're constantly struggling, but they do wind up getting married, but now there's a problem at his company.
Yeah.
You've also written, three novels together?
Yes, three novels. Three novels and one nonfiction book together.
Okay. I read Beyond the Grave, which I found quite fascinating, partly because it takes place in the area around Santa Barbara, where both my parents once lived and my sister still lives. It's set in really two time frames, and I'm guessing that Marcia wrote the section set in 1986, and Bill wrote the section set in 1894, or is that not the case?
That's correct. Those two characters, Marcia's character, Elena Olivares, and my detective, John Quincannon, are secondary series characters that we both developed. I still write John Quincannon stories. Marcia is no longer writing the Elena Olivares series, but at the time that book was written, the series were both being done, so we thought we'd see if we could combine the two, set the challenge of being able to write a novel set in two time frames.
And when you did that, did you sit down and work out the plot in advance, or did one of you write a section, then the other write a section?
Well, in that book, we each wrote our own sections about our own series characters. We plotted it. We plotted it in segments. I think, maybe 50 pages at a time.
Yeah, it would be about 50 pages.
So you didn't necessarily know what was going to happen at the end?
No, we didn't. No. It was such a challenge to be able to work on a book like that, to see whether or not we could pull it off, to have all the parts mesh where, my character in the in the 1890s could solve part of the case, and then Marcia's character could solve the rest of it, so that they had equal time and equal abilities in solving the case.
Because I will say, I don't know if I give myself any special credit, but I could figure out fairly far easy early on where the treasure was hidden, but I never would have guessed how it was discovered in the end.
Well, that's good to hear.
And then other books of yours, like Nightcrawlers, you know, or you just assume, since it's this sort of novel, that it'll turn out relatively well, but...
It's more of, Nightcrawlers is more of a, I don't particularly like labels, but what it is is a procedural suspense novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's a detective novel, but it's not a whodunit. It's more of a thriller. You know it's going to turn out okay, but you don't know what might happen to the characters along the way.
So the question I was leading up to was, in this case, did you know exactly how it was going to end, or did that come out of the writing also?
It came out of the characters. I knew approximately what I wanted to happen, but I never know, except for one book, I've never known when I begin a book how it will end. Because mm-hmm. it changes, as Marcia said, it changes... because of the character development as the writing progresses.
And I imagine that when you get together with other mystery writers, many of them, the plot-driven ones, are exactly the opposite. They have to know everything before they can even begin.
Yeah, there are some people like that. They'll do very elaborate outlines, and I always view them as very short first drafts because they're so detailed. Neither of us can work that way.
So what got you into the mystery field? Marcia, you wrote in your website that it was, you started doing that when you bogged down in journalism because this is what you like to read.
Yes, I was reading everything I could in the field and kept thinking, well, maybe I could do this. I had always wanted to write. In fact, I wrote my first book about my dog at age 12.
To good reviews, you say.
I had problems because my creative writing teacher in college told me I would never be a writer. So I backed off and went into journalism, which I was no good at because I kind of embellished stories.
How much did you have to learn about the trade, either of you? Because I suppose a person could make up a private eye just from reading other private eye novels, but at a certain point you have to know what the police procedure is for this or for that. And how private investigators really interact with the regular police.
Yes, you do. I did a lot of research from written sources before I started writing, and even textbooks on crime solving. And since then, I've met a number of private investigators and have been happy to hear that they say it approximates reality, except, of course, shown that it's much more exciting than theirs.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same with my character.
Yeah, and in general, modern procedural mysteries, either police or private eyes, what they emphasize, unlike Sherlock Holmes or Lord Peter Wimsey or Hercule Poirot, is the tediousness of it all. Or the
well, it's not tedious. It's routine.
Routineness of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And it is a very routine type of job. We jazz it up naturally for in order to make it readable fiction. But basically, that type of detective work is rather dull. Most private investigators do the bulk of their work on computers. They never leave their office.
So in that case. In that case, probably, is it Mick Savage? The
yes.
nephew is the archetypal modern detective?
He, the techie kind of detective, yes. Computers have made our job a lot harder because we have to come, information is so readily available that we have to come up with additional complications in order for there to be anything to solve at all.
And in the other book of the one novel of Marcia's I've read, A Walk Through the Fire, that's another one where I wonder how totally it may have been plotted in advance, because it's one where I had no idea how it was going to turn out and what the twists were. But they all seemed quite plausible at the end, more than in most mysteries.
No, well, that's very good to hear.
Is this a case where your first draft, you sort of had an idea, and then in future drafts you...
No, actually I didn't. That one, I probably had more of an idea earlier on than I normally do. Some of my books, I have literally come to the end and not been able to figure out quite how it worked. In fact, I had one where the killers switched in a final confrontation where Sharon looked around the room and thought, oh no, it's not this guy, it's the one over there.
And I hope she was right.
One of the other collaborations we did double with Sharon McComb and Nameless, working on a common case. We had a problem because of, we had three murders in the novel, and we wrote a draft of it and thought that it was a finished book, and we realized as we were out celebrating the end of the book that we had not solved one of the cases, one of the murders. We had three murders and only had two murders. So we had to go back and rewrite and take care of the problem. So you can sometimes write yourself into a corner by not plotting ahead. But in the long run, it seems to work best for us to just let it happen. It's the same voyage of discovery as a reader has. You find out what's happening, what's going on as you go along.
And you do about one book a year, or I guess, Bill, you do even more, because you've I guess, edited 100 anthologies, and Marcia, and the two of you have edited some together. What is the drive to do so much?
Money. Pay the bills.
For me, at the beginning, I had to do two books a year because publishers were just not paying enough that I could live on the advance from one book. Lately I've cut back to one book a year, and that's starting to seem like an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what I do now, too. Neither of us does the quantity of work that we used to. We're getting older, we don't need to, we don't have the stamina, for one thing, but we also don't need to work as hard as we once did. So we're essentially one book a year writers now.
Yeah, and your characters are getting older, too. My guess is
although they're aging a lot more slowly than we are.
Okay, my guess is that Nameless is about 15 years older than Sharon.
No, he's 62. He's actually about my age.
Mm-hmm.
And Sharon's in her early 40s. When I started writing her, we were the same age, and I've gone on ahead of her. But with the aging process, you have to ask the reader to suspend his disbelief, because otherwise, you know, these people would be getting so old they wouldn't be able to do the things they do.
Yeah, and pretty soon Nameless is going to retire, I assume?
He's semi-retired now. That's why I brought in a new character into the series, Jake Runyon, who takes care of a lot of the field work involved in the cases. And he's become a major figure in the series now. So it's not just Nameless any longer.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, in Nightcrawlers, he was really the emotional center of the book. How are he and his son getting along now?
They're not. They're still estranged. But I've given him a woman to interact with. Not necessarily a love interest, but a relationship that alleviates some of his loneliness and grief over the death of his wife.
So how long are you going to keep going?
Well, I have three more books under contract, and I'll keep going as long as they want me to.
Same here. Writers write. That's what we do. It's what we are. We need a reason to get up in the morning. There's no retirement here. We'll write as long as we're able to publish and physically able to do the work.
This is Booktown for Monday, the 14th of May, 2007. I'm Eric Thom. KVMR is undergoing a membership drive at this time, so Booktown has been preempted. This program is online only. We just heard from mystery writers Marcia Mueller and Bill Pronzini. She's best known for her Sharon McCone mysteries, he for his Nameless Detective. They'll be appearing at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City this coming Friday, the 18th, at 7:30 p.m. Two of their recent novels, his Nightcrawlers, takes place partially in Nevada County, as does her Vanishing Point. Kurt Vonnegut died just over a month ago. This is something of a shock for many people, even though he was in his mid-80s and had retired from novel writing. He couldn't stop giving his opinions, usually pretty acerbic and quite often pretty negative about the state of human society. And nobody expected him to suddenly die from a fall in his apartment. That's what happened, and as I think back on him, I try to assess what he has meant to me and so many other people. I think he may well have been the most important writer of my time, certainly the most important American writer. This is far from saying he's the best, the most original, the most finished, or anything else. But I think he brought a perspective, a common sense, sentimental cynicism to our world just when we need it the most, that is, in the middle of the Vietnam War. He had been this way before the war began, and he's continued the same way for the 30, 40 years since. And now in a time when things are as bad or as worse than they were when I first experienced him, I realize how much we're going to miss him. I've been looking around for ways of honoring him, to maybe read something of his, or even better, hear something in his own voice, because there's no way that I can come anywhere close to his particular Midwestern drawl. We're both Midwesterners, but I wind up sounding more like an effete East Coaster, and he winds up sounding more and more like Mark Twain. But I am going to read in my effete East Coast voice a selection from one of my favorite of his books, a selection of essays called Palm Sunday. The very last one is called In the Capital of the World, about his life in New York. But in particular, he talks about one event. This is what he has to say. The people in this city have been very friendly to me, although I was born far away. They have uses for strangers who do good work in the arts here, and I have done reasonably good work as a novelist from time to time. The most satisfying kindness which has been done to me here was an invitation from St. Clement's Episcopal Church, whose congregation includes many actors, to preach on Palm Sunday in 1980. It is the custom of that church, which is also a theater, to have a stranger preach just once a year. The altar there is portable, since the front of the church is also a stage. Very few plays would work well with an altar as a fixed centerpiece. So on the morning I preached, the altar had been trundled temporarily onto a set, which was the kitchen of a Manhattan tenement of perhaps 60 years ago or more, before I was born. I do not know what that play the set was for. I have not asked. I want to imagine that it was for a play about European immigrants in New York City and their children. I was happy to speak from that set as a descendant of immigrants who settled much farther inland, immigrants about whom native New Yorkers often know nothing and imagine the worst. I had this to say. I am enchanted by the Sermon on the Mount. Being merciful, it seems to me, is the only good idea we have received so far. Perhaps we will get another idea that good by and by, and then we will still have two good ideas. What might that second good idea be? I don't know. How could I know? I will make a wild guess that it will come from music somehow. I have often wondered what music is and why we love it so. It may be that music is the second good idea is being born. I choose as my text the first 8 verses of John 12, which deal not with Palm Sunday, but with the night before, with Palm Sunday Eve, with what we might call Spikenard Saturday. I hope that will be close enough to Palm Sunday to leave you more or less satisfied. I asked an Episcopalian priest the other day what I should say to you about Palm Sunday itself. She told me to say that it was a brilliant satire on pomp and circumstance and high honors in this world. So I tell you that. The priest was Carol Anderson, who sold her physical church in order that her spiritual parish might survive. Her parish is All Angels on West 80th, just off Broadway. She sold the church, but hung on to the parish house. I assume that most, if not all, of the angels are still around. Now as to the verses about Palm Sunday Eve, I choose them because Jesus says something in the 8th verse, which many people I've known have taken as proof that Jesus himself occasionally got sick and tired of people who needed mercy all the time. I read from the Revised Standard Bible rather than the King James because it is easier for me to understand. Also, I will argue afterwards that Jesus was only joking, and it is impossible to joke in King James English. The funniest joke in the world, if told in King James English, is doomed to sound like Charlton Heston. I read, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper. Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those at the table with him. Mary took a pound of costly ointment of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the ointment. But Jesus Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief, and as he had the money box, he used to take what was put into it. Jesus said, "Let her alone. Let her keep it for the day of my burial. The poor you have always with you, but you do not always have me." Thus ends the reading, and although I have promised a joke, there's not much of a chuckle in there anywhere. The reading, in fact, ends with at least two quite depressing implications: that Jesus could be a touch self-pitying, and that he was, with his mission to earth about to end, at least momentarily sick and tired of hearing about the poor. The King James Version of the last verse, by the way, is almost identical. "For the poor always ye have with you, but you do not always have me." Whatever it was that Jesus really said to Judas was said in Aramaic, of course, and has come to us through Hebrew and Greek and Latin and archaic English. Maybe he only had something like, "The poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." Perhaps a little something has been lost in translation. And let us remember, too, that in translation, jokes are commonly the first things to go. I would like to recapture what has been lost. Why? Because I, as a Christ-worshipping agnostic, have seen so much unchristian impatience with the poor, encouraged by the quotation, "For the poor have ye always with you." I'm speaking mainly of my youth in Indianapolis, Indiana. No matter where I am and how old I become, I still speak of almost nothing but my youth in Indianapolis, Indiana. Whenever anybody out there that way began to worry a lot about the poor people when I was young, some eminently respectable Hoosier, possibly an uncle or an aunt, would say that Jesus himself had given up on doing much about the poor. He or she would paraphrase John 12, verse 8, "The poor people are hopeless. We'll always be stuck with them." The general company was then free to say that the poor were hopeless because they were so lazy or dumb, that they drank too much or had too many children, and kept coal in the bathtub and so on. Somebody was likely to quote Kim Hubbard, the Hoosier humorist, who said that he knew a man who was so poor he owned 22 dogs, and so on. If those Hoosiers were still alive, which they are not, I would tell them now that Jesus was only joking, and that he was not even thinking much about the poor. I would tell them, too, what I don't have to tell this particular congregation, that jokes can be noble. Laughs are exactly as honorable as tears. Laughter and tears are both responses to frustration and exhaustion, to the futility of thinking and striving anymore. I myself prefer to laugh, since there is less cleaning up to do afterward, and since I can start thinking and striving again that much sooner. All right. It is the evening before Palm Sunday. Jesus is frustrated and exhausted. He knows that one of his closest associates will soon betray him for money, and that he is going to be mocked and tortured and killed. He's going to feel all that a mortal feels when he dies in convulsions on the cross. His visit among us is almost over, but life must still go on for just a little while. It is again supper time. How many supper times does Jesus have left? 5, I believe. His male companions for the supper are themselves a mockery. One is Judas, who will betray him. The other is Lazarus, who has recently been dead for 4 days. Lazarus was so dead that he stunk, the Bible says. Lazarus is surely dazed and not much of a conversationalist, and not necessarily grateful either to be alive again. It is a very mixed blessing to be brought back from the dead. If I had read a little further, we would have learned that there's a crowd outside, crazy to see Lazarus, not Jesus. Lazarus is the man of the hour as far as the crowd is concerned. Trust a crowd to look at the wrong end of a miracle every time. There are 2 sisters of Lazarus here, Martha and Mary. They, at least, are sympathetic and imaginatively helpful. Mary begins to massage and perfume the feet of Jesus Christ with an ointment made from spikenard plant. Jesus has the bones of a man who is clothed in the flesh of a man, so it must feel awfully nice what Mary is doing to his feet. Would it be heretical of us to suppose that Jesus closes his eyes? This is too much for that envious, pious hypocrite Judas, who says, trying to be more Catholic than the Pope, "Hey, this is very unchristian. Instead of wasting that stuff on your feet, you should have sold it and given the money to the poor people." To which Jesus replies in Aramaic, "Judas, don't worry about it. There will still be plenty of poor people left long after I'm gone." This is about what Mark Twain or Abraham Lincoln would have said under similar circumstances. If Jesus did in fact say that, it is a divine black joke, well suited to the occasion. It says everything about hypocrisy and nothing about the poor. It is a Christian joke which allows Jesus to remain civil to Judas, but to chide him about his hypocrisy all the same. "Judas, don't worry about it. There will still be plenty of poor people left long after I'm gone." Shall I regarble it for you? "The poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." My own translation does no violence to the words in the Bible. I've changed their order some, not merely to make them into the joke the situation calls for, but to harmonize them, too, with the Sermons on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount suggests a mercifulness that can never waver or fade. This has no doubt been a silly sermon. I am sure you do not mind. People don't come to church for preachments, of course, but to daydream about God. I thank you for your sweetly faked attention. More Vonnegut, this time in his own voice. We're going to hear an interview conducted by Don Swaim in CBS Radio's New York studio in 1981.
A very good interview with you here in Palm Sunday. You know what we could do? You know, I could just ask the questions and you could read the answers right out of your book.
Well, the questions are mine. It's a completely rigged interview. It's a Paris review. Does these interviews with writers, and mine went so badly, really. It was so cumbersome, done the honest way, that I asked for the opportunity to rewrite it. And so I did, because I spent about 2 weeks on it, and it finally came out more or less as it should. It would have been very embarrassing if the real interview had been published.
I'm sure your questions were better anyway.
But I knew what the funny answers were.
Well, in your first book, Player Piano, you quote from Matthew in the Bible, "Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin." Now, for a man who appears to object to organized religion as much as you do. Apparently you do think that the Bible does have some good things to say.
Oh, well, how could anyone object to the Bible as literature? It's, my goodness, one of the great men of all time who goes totally unacknowledged is Lancelot Andrews, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare's and who was in fact in charge of the translation of the Bible into King James English. And of course everyone assumes that this is how God talked, and God no doubt speaks beautifully, but these words happen to be Lancelot Andrews.
But it's not the Bible obviously does not carry the word of law to you.
No, well, I honor my ancestors, as I think everyone else tries to do, and our family has been agnostic or atheistic for many generations now, and we've behaved decently and are to be trusted in business and as courageous as most people.
Well, at a Civil Liberties Union fundraiser, you spoke about Thomas Aquinas and his theory that human law was a poor relation to what he called divine law or natural law. What's wrong with this?
Well, it may be true, but the highest law we have in this country, and I say thank God for that, is human law, is the laws we make ourselves. And Aquinas talks about other laws, which he sees as apparent. In fact, most of us do. He sees nature's laws, natural law, says that is higher than man's law, and higher than that is God's law. And of course, he was a Catholic, and this is a Catholic point of view. If this point of view were honored in the courts, we would be in a great deal of trouble in this country. We would have a theocracy, as they do in Iran now, and priests would in fact be in charge of us, telling us what God's law is. And our founding fathers, while utterly respectful of God, said that we really couldn't know what God's wishes were. The only clear indications we had of, was of what men themselves needed. And so we have only the lowest form of law operating in this country, which is man's law, and that's what makes this nation such a thrilling experience, is that there are not religious people who can pull their rank on us by saying what God wants.
Well, what do you believe the role of a theologian should be in our society, or should it have a role at all?
Well, I haven't spent much time with theologians. They are religious historians, among other things, and after all, the holy texts we have come through many languages to us, from Aramaic to Hebrew to Greek, and finally to Middle English, and finally into modern English. So theologians can be very useful in going back over those old texts to see what was actually said long ago. They are historians. They can surely speculate about what God may want or what the purpose of the universe is. And of course, I make my living the same way, as I certainly want to know what's going on, and I have a great deal of fun speculating about it.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut, what do you think causes man the most harm? Sexual excessiveness, obscenity, adherence to certain religious teachings?
Well, what is causing the most harm now, as we live in modern times, is carelessness. As in the past, a person behaving carelessly could accidentally poison one well, for instance, and there would be millions of wells left on the surface of the planet where we could still get decent water. But now, with our carelessness, with our heedlessness, we are poisoning whole rivers, as perhaps we'll poison whole oceans, as the Mediterranean is pretty well shot now. And so I think our carelessness is really doing far more damage to our health than anything else we do. Mugging is very bad, too. Armed robbery.
And you're a New Yorker, you should know.
I find this the least alarming city I've ever been in. I don't even know anyone who's been mugged. I know Andrew Stein slightly. He was mugged, but I've lived here for quite a while, and I've seen very little ugliness. I've certainly seen a lot of poverty.
You're not afraid to walk the streets of New York?
Yes, I'm afraid, as I'm alert, and I think about it, but in fact, nothing much ever seems to happen.
As you discussed fully in Palm Sunday, Slaughterhouse 5 has been banned in one Long Island school district. It was burned in a furnace in North Dakota. But shouldn't the people who object to your writings have the right to suppress those writings if they see them as being harmful?
Not if they are public officials. As private persons, they can certainly exclude my books from their home. They can tell their children that they should not read these books. But the people who have banned these books are, in fact, public officials who are intended to represent all sorts of opinions in their community and not merely their own opinions. So any enemy of my book, as he's certainly entitled to be my enemy, but if he is an official, he has no right under the Constitution to take official action against what I've written.
Are you worried about the influence of the moral majority?
I don't know. It's like being worried walking around New York, as I haven't been hurt yet and really don't expect to be hurt. And religious conservatives have been around a long time and have done not much harm. We will have to see if they start doing actual damage. I'm not frightened of them in advance of the event.
From your Manhattan viewing post, do you believe that the moral majority is going to play a role in influencing the Reagan administration?
I have no idea, as we will have to see what happened. I mean, the administration just began, and so it is only talk now. Yes, it could turn very ugly, but that potential has always existed in this country. There's a potential to go fascist, to go communist, to go crazy in many ways. We haven't done it yet, thanks largely to the Supreme Court and the great keel of the Constitution.
You have kind of a wait-and-see attitude with regard to the Reagan administration, I assume.
Well, that seems only reasonable, yes.
Still on the honeymoon. No doubt a lot of people consider you profane, and in Palm Sunday you include your short story, The Great Space Fuck.
Yes, this is the first story with fuck in its title, I believe. Yes.
And no doubt you've read the explicit passages in Cheever's Falconer and in Styron Sophie's Choice. Why can't fiction writers such as yourself write nice, clean books like Steinbeck did?
Well, I in fact do write nice, clean books. As it's been said that, you know, one man who had heard that I was being censored all over the place made it his business to read everything I'd written. And he said he could learn more about sex from talking to a 14-year-old for 5 minutes than he could from reading every one of my books. There was a time when we all censored ourselves because there seemed reason to suspect that sexual scenes, dirty language, might actually upset children. And we were willing to believe that. But more and more research was done on the effects of pornography on people in lunatic asylums, people in prisons, people known to have criminal backgrounds, and ordinary people and so forth. And the evidence came in over the past 20 years that people were not, in fact, damaged by reading the word fuck, for example.
Well, you have raised 6 children. What would your reaction have been were one of your kids were to come up to you and use the word fuck? Would you have become angry? Because they're grown now, but not much you can do now, but how would you have reacted during this period when they were growing up?
Well, I suppose the problem did come up, but for one reason or another, they were most cleanly spoken, really. I suppose they experimented with the word fuck now and then. I mean, after all, their peers get to them long before the parents do, and so their peers had already told them, you know, you mustn't say this in public, or you mustn't say it to your parents.
Mm-hmm. This sexual explicitness in literature today, that doesn't bother you at all?
Yes, it offends me some. It's 42nd Street causes considerable discomfort, but it seems ugly to me. But at the same time, it seems the price we pay for the First Amendment, for the right to say anything we want to. And we want to hang on to this right, not for sexual reasons, but for political reasons, that we want to be able to speak against people who are misruling us, who are defiling the country in one way or another. And very marginally, there is the freedom to speak about sex. And this is the freedom to speak about our own bodies. For one thing, 50 years ago, people had very incomplete vocabularies for their bodies. Had trouble conducting conversations with doctors and nurses and so forth about where they hurt and what the symptoms were. The body was so embarrassing somehow, and all the words were so embarrassing. So I welcome the freedom to discuss our bodies, and yes, our sex lives too. Why not?
The vocabulary is complete today.
Yes, I think so, and quite simple and clear.
I noticed you are smoking, but in your book you say that you have given up booze. You used to make long distance calls and write some crazy letters and so forth. Don't you think under the circumstances that the booze might be more preferable, however, to heavy smoking?
No, because, well, I suppose the cigarettes will shorten my life considerably, and I've already outlived F. Scott Fitzgerald and D.H. Lawrence and a good many other people, so I'm sort of a post-grad now anyway. I've had all the time anybody should need. No, the booze damaged my mind, and it made it difficult for me to think clearly. I have enough trouble thinking clearly when I'm sober. And it also induced a lot of futile anger and so forth, so it was disagreeable.
Did you try to write while you were drinking?
Yeah, well, I think every writer has, and there's only one writer who has written well while drunk, so far as I know, is a man who wrote Under the Volcano. What the hell is his name?
It'll come to it. It's all right. It's all right. It'll come to it. But H.L. Mencken used to claim to be a heavy drinker. It may have been exaggerated, however, but he would always say that his drinking would start when he went away from his typewriter. Can't drinking still be part of life? William Styron was quoted as saying that he's a man who likes his martinis. But can't drinking be separated from a writer's work?
Yeah, well, I take drinks now and then. I just realized I was drinking too much, and so I went for a year without drinking at all, which wasn't very difficult to do, and now I do take a drink now and then. Just historically, no one has been able to write well while drunk, as I think we'd all be willing to do it and happy to do it if we could.
How did it happen that you, as a science fiction writer, cut through this category and then began to appeal to just about all segments of society, except maybe some of your relatives in Indianapolis?
Well, it was and science fiction is an unfair literary ghetto anyway, as I was thrust into it without wishing to live in that particular part of town. Because I understood something about technology and included it in my books, and the feeling still exists that anyone who knows how his refrigerator works can't possibly be an artist too. And what I was trained as an engineer and a chemist. And so when I wrote my first book, Player Piano, it was full of machinery, and it was about General Electric Company, as it was in Schenectady in 1950. And this seemed like fantasy about 3,000 years in the future to persons who've never hung around in factories. And so I was unfairly categorized as a science fiction writer, and I say it was unfair because the pay was lower, much lower for science fiction writers than the supposedly true artists, the truly sensitive, creative people. And I wanted to get paid as much as anybody, and I wanted to be reviewed as seriously as anybody. So I kicked about it in an essay in the New York Times. Also, I think I've taken more time with what I've written. What, in my whole life, I've written 9 novels now. And an ordinary science fiction writer do about 3 a year, I would think. And Isaac Asimov has done 5 as we sit here and talk.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut, you were working at the GE plant in Schenectady as a public relations man, and I guess that's when you started work on your first novel. But you decided to go freelance, to make this a full-time occupation for you. Now, that's a risky undertaking for many people. Did you have a grubstake, or how did you engineer?
Well, it wasn't risky in those days. It was the golden age of magazines, and if you could write a short story, you get paid pretty damn well for it. And if Collier's didn't buy it, the Saturday Evening Post would buy it, and if neither one of them would buy it, Red Book would. And in those days, the world was a wonderful pinball machine for story writers. You know, the ball would keep bouncing down and down and down and down till somebody bought the darn thing, and that's all over with. And at General Electric, I couldn't get a raise. Because I wasn't old enough yet. It was an age-graded society, and I had a couple of kids. So I started writing short stories on weekends, and I sold my first story for 7 weeks' pay. And I sold my second story for 10 weeks' pay. You know, that was about 3 weeks later. And I suddenly had this currency piling up in the corners there, you know. $5 bills blowing all over the house, and I was wondering what the hell I was going downtown for.
It's connected to you, then.
Yeah.
You make a lot of references to being German-American, and as if you really have to defend it. Now, my wife is a German-American, and although she feels herself as being completely American, and she thinks Germany is probably incurable. And that's that. That's as far as it goes. Do you carry around with you a feeling of guilt or something for being a German-American?
I run into... no, I don't... Hell no. I haven't done anything bad. And neither have any of my relatives, but I do run into a certain amount of resentment, and, you know, people who want to tell me that they've been hurt by Germany in some way, and they can be quite unpleasant about it. And so I respond to that. The world is a zoo, and, I mean, this is a great unracist city. At the same time, everybody is very clever about spotting every possible breed. You know, it's also like the Westminster Kennel Club, where everybody knows what everybody else is in pretty good detail.
Well, I talked to William Manchester a while back, and he was saying that he harbors no resentment toward the Japanese today or the Germans today, the young ones, but whenever he runs into an older Japanese, one his age, because he was shot in the Pacific Theater, or an older German, there is a resentment there. He can sense it because they were enemies in the 1940s. And he says their relationship will never be the same. Do you have any of that feeling? You were a prisoner of war.
I was a prisoner of war, and I got to know him pretty good. And I found them dumb in annoying ways, the people who guarded us. Again, you know, what German are we talking about? There's some very agreeable old ones, too, like Heinrich Bull and Günter Grass, who are planetary citizens, and two of the most adorable people I know. So, sure, I sure like Heinrich Bull, who fought on the Russian front, and I like Günter Grass, who was a draft dodger. And, there's a couple of good Germans.
What's it like living and working in New York City? You know, a lot of authors like to tuck themselves away in little New England-type villages, but here you are in the biggest of all cities.
Well, I lived on Cape Cod for 20 years, and so I have a pretty good idea what that's like. And as long as I was young and alarmed and ambitious and all that, my surroundings didn't matter much to me. But as I got older and sleepier and all that, I really needed the excitement of a city to keep going. And specifically this city. Chicago wouldn't do it. Rome wouldn't do it. Paris wouldn't do it.
Our sirens don't keep you awake at night?
Oh, no. But this is, to me, the art capital of the world. It's a thrilling place to live. And if I were still on Cape Cod, I would be asleep all the time.
How do you feel having your wife, Jill Crimmins, snap your picture every time you turn around?
Well, it could almost be made into a movie. You know, I've been just frame by frame by frame, and she keeps getting new cameras and equipment and stuff and testing it out. And I'm her test pattern again and again and again. As before she goes out to work, she fires a couple of times at me to make things sure everything is working well.
And finally, here's Kurt Vonnegut reading from one of his most famous novels, Slaughterhouse-Five.
Billy Pilgrim could not sleep on his daughter's wedding night. He was 44. The wedding had taken place that afternoon in a gaily striped tent in Billy's backyard. The stripes were orange and black. Billy padded downstairs on his blue and ivory feet. He went into the kitchen where the moonlight called his attention to a half bottle of champagne on the kitchen table, all that was left from the reception in the tent. Somebody had stoppered it again. "Drink me," it seemed to say. So Billy uncorked it with his thumbs, didn't make a pop. The champagne was dead. So it goes. Billy looked at the clock on the gas stove. He had an hour to kill before the saucer came. He went into the living room, swinging the bottle like a dinner bell, turned on the television. He came slightly unstuck in time, saw the late movie backwards, then forwards again. It was a movie about American bombers in the Second World War and the gallant men who flew them. Seen backwards by Billy, the story went like this. American planes, full of holes and wounded men and corpses, took off backwards from an airfield in England. Over France, a few German fighter planes flew at them backwards, sucked bullets and shell fragments from some of the planes and crewmen. They did the same for wrecked American bombers on the ground, and those planes flew up backwards to join the formation. The formation flew backwards over a German city that was in flames. The bombers opened their bomb bay doors, exerted a miraculous magnetism which shrunk the fires, gathered them into cylindrical steel containers, and lifted the containers into the bellies of the planes. The containers were stored neatly in racks. The German below had miraculous devices of their own, which were long steel tubes. They used them to suck more fragments from the crewmen and planes. But there were still a few wounded Americans, and some of the bombers were in bad repair. Over France, though, German fighter planes came up again, made everything and everybody as good as new. When the bombers got back to their base, the steel cylinders were taken from the racks and shipped back to the United States of America, where factories were operating night and day, dismantling the cylinders, separating the dangerous contents into minerals. Touchingly, it was mainly women who did this work. The minerals were then shipped to specialists in remote areas. It was their business to put them into the ground to hide them cleverly, so they would never hurt anybody ever again. American flyers turned in their uniforms, became high school kids, and Hitler turned into a baby, Billy Pilgrim supposed. That wasn't in the movie. Billy was extrapolating. Everybody turned into a baby, and all humanity, without exception, conspired biologically to produce two perfect people named Adam and Eve, Billy Pilgrim supposed. Billy saw the war movie backwards and forwards, and then it was time to go out into his backyard to meet the flying saucer. Out he went, his blue and ivory feet crushing the wet salad of the lawn. He stopped, took a swig of the dead champagne. It was like 7-Up. He would not raise his eyes to the sky, though he knew there was a flying saucer from Tralfamador up there. He would see it soon enough, inside and out, and he would see, too, where it came from soon enough. Soon enough. Overhead, he heard the cry of what might have been a melodious owl, but it wasn't a melodious owl. It was a flying saucer from Tralfamador, navigating in both space and time, therefore seeming to Billy Pilgrim to have come from nowhere all at once. Somewhere a big dog barked. The saucer was 100 feet in diameter, with portholes around its rim. The light from the portholes was a pulsing purple. The only noise it made was the owl song. It came down to hover over Billy and to enclose him in a cylinder of pulsing purple light. Now there was a sound of a seeming kiss as an airtight hatch in the bottom of the saucer was opened. Down snaked a ladder that was outlined in pretty lights like a Ferris wheel. Billy's will was paralyzed by a zap gun aimed at him from one of the portholes. It became imperative that he take hold of the bottom rung of the sinuous ladder, which he did. The rung was electrified, so that Billy's hand locked onto it hard. He was hauled into the airlock and machinery closed the bottom door. Only then did the ladder, wound onto a reel in the airlock, let him go. Only then did Billy's brain start working again. There were two peepholes inside the airlock, with yellow eyes pressed to them. There was a speaker on the wall. The Tralfamadorians had no voice boxes. They communicated telepathically. They were able to talk to Billy by means of a computer and a sort of electric organ which made every Earthling speech sound. "Welcome aboard, Mr. Pilgrim," said the loudspeaker. "Any questions?" Billy licked his lips, thought a while, inquired at last, "Why me?" "That is a very Earthling question to ask, Mr. Pilgrim. Why you? Why us, for that matter? Why anything? Because this moment simply is. Have you ever seen bugs trapped in amber?" "Yes," said Billy. In fact, he had a paperweight in his office, which was a blob of polished amber with three ladybugs embedded in it. "Well, here we are, Mr. Pilgrim, trapped in the amber of this moment. There is no why."
That was the late Kurt Vonnegut reading from his novel Slaughterhouse-Five. To find out about the recordings you've heard today, you can go to the Booktown blog, which is booktown.blogspot.com, or you can Google Kurt Vonnegut recordings to find many more. Marcia Miller and Bill Pronzini, who appeared at the beginning of this program, will be at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City this Friday, the 18th of May, at 7:30 p.m. Another event coming up this weekend at the Bookseller in Grass Valley on Saturday the 19th at 3 p.m. Cheryl Angelina Kohler will be presenting her book Touring in the Sierra Nevada, a brand new auto guidebook to sites and towns and rivers and lakes and everything else in the Sierra Nevada from top to bottom. This has been an online-only edition of Booktown. If you happen to tune it on at 1 p.m. on Monday, you can go back to KVMR now and catch Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party. If not, you can do it some other time.